Baker Street Babes would like to thank their sponsors. First of all, the Baker Street Journal, the premier publication of scholarship about Sherlock Holmes. The Baker Street Journal continues to be the leading Sherlockian publication since its founding in 1946 by Edgar W. Smith. With both serious scholarship and articles that play the game, the journal is essential reading for anyone interested in Sherlock Holmes through Arthur Conan Doyle and a world where it is always 1895. To find out more, go to www.bakerstreetjournal.com. We would also like to say thank you to our sponsor, Wessex Press, dedicated to the study of Sherlock Holmes and his world. Whether you've just discovered the great detective or you're a seasoned Sherlockian, we're sure you'll find many unique volumes to pique your interest. Go to www.wessexpress.com to find out more. Last but not least, we would like to say thank you to the Scintillation of Science. The Scintillation is an annual symposium of fans of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, sponsored by Watson's Tin Box in Maryland, USA. The event includes speakers and attendees from around the US as well as local Sherlockians. This year's Scintillation is taking place June 6 and 7 in Hanover, MD. For more information and to register, go to www.scintillation.org, and that's spelled Scintillation. See you there.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're you crying, won't you two one?
Welcome to episode 54 of the Baker Street Babes. We are talking about my new book, which I'm very excited about. It's called The Detective, the Woman, and the Silent Hive, and it's a novel of Sherlock Holmes, like the others. And Melinda, Caffers, and Sarah are here to talk about the book. So before the other girls get into asking questions, they had asked me to give a little synopsis. The series of books that I write are about Sherlock Holmes and Irene Adler, and they are post-Great Hiatus. They are a little later on in canon timing. In the first book, which was set in Florida, Sherlock Holmes and Irene Adler meet back up and become at least tentatively friends, and then Irene ends up actually moving to Sussex while Holmes is still in London. And the second book was set in Sussex in the village. This book is set in London, so it's definitely the traditional setting of the stories, and it's very much Holmes's world. I would say the first book, they were kind of both out of their element. The second one was very much in the world of Irene and the world of the village. And this is very much Holmes's world with Victorian London, you know, taxis, gaslights, the whole nine yards. And it ties to the canon case, The Five Orange Pips, which is one of my favorites. And built on what I see as kind of an open ending of that story to some extent, kind of ties that to something that happens a little bit later in Irene and Sherlock's lives.
Not a lot of people would say that that's their favorite story. It's not a lot of fun sometimes.
it's about the KKK.
a lot of people just don't even want to go there. Mm-hmm. And Holmes makes a mistake in that case that, to us, having watched hundreds of police procedurals, looks like a really stupid mistake.
Right.
So I'm interested in why that's one of your favorites and why you chose to add it into your novel.
Thank you. I like that question. You know, my very, very favorite story, which I said when I became a babe long ago, is the Copper Beeches. But I really like the Five Orange Pips as well, because I do like the fact that Holmes makes a mistake. I like stories in which we see that, because we see that he's not a completely infallible person. And I think we see a little bit of Holmes' humanity in that, because we see that he's sad about losing a client. Obviously, a lot of that is because he feels like he failed. But at the same time, you see a spark of kind of, you know, human feeling there at an earlier point in the canon where he's not maybe his totally mature self yet. And I find the ending of it really interesting. If for people who may not be as familiar with the story, Holmes basically finds out that the KKK is involved in basically killing off people who know where the bodies are buried, I would say. And he kind of has the case nailed down, and basically once this particular miscreant gets back to the United States, the assumption is that he'll be arrested because Holmes has sent word on that he's wanted for murder, but he never reaches his destination, and it's kind of a very poetic ending to the story that Doyle wrote, that, you know, they find part of the ship and they, you know, the assumption is that everyone on board perished, and it's kind of a poetic justice, I guess, sort of situation. And I just found it really interesting rereading that. I think I was researching for a blog post or something. And I thought, you know, this is a really interesting story because we never find out really any of the fallout of this, that Holmes has sent this information on. And basically Watson, as narrator, says that they never heard anything else about this. And as somebody from the United States, I find the American connections to Sherlock Holmes always very interesting. And this is one where the KKK, which has been such a huge and unfortunate part of U.S. history, and especially the South, which is where I'm from, and where Sarah has spent a lot of her life as well, it's such a big part of our history, and it was so interesting to me that it intersected with Holmes in such a kind of a relatively small way. But it occurred to me, you know, what if there was more to this story? What if this, you know, this never hearing about this again, what if something else comes up later without spoiling too much of what happens in the book? What if this wasn't put to bed quite as much as Holmes thought it was? And so I guess for me, being an American and having an interest in that story and what it kind of, how it bumps into American history, interested me. Sorry, that was really long.
No, it's very interesting to listen to you, especially because I've just been reading a synopsis, unfortunately, because I haven't actually read The Five Orange Pips. But it is an interesting story in that it does have like a lot of American connections to do with the ships and the history. Like, there's a lot of history like interwoven into it, which obviously at the time would have been fairly contemporary.
Right.
And it's quite interesting to look at it in that way, because for us, it's kind of like this was something that happened, but like for them, it's like something that was still happening.
Right.
So like people were still being, you know, chased after for, yep, like information about that.
Well, and Doyle touches in the story through Watson, obviously through Watson's voice. I'm not playing the game here, so I'm saying Doyle, but he touches on the fact that the KKK at the time was in disfavor technically with sort of the government, but there was a lot of activity still going on. And that was another thing that prompted me, because it's like you're seeing the sort of English perspective of, oh, well, you know, they're rounding these people up. It's, you know, it's going down. It's not as big of a deal. And like you said, that was contemporary to the time, but unfortunately that didn't really work, if you will. Like it didn't go away. I had, you know, as someone who, you know, has grown up in the United States and is aware of Southern history, you know, in the years following, if Doyle had wanted to, there would have been plenty of KKK activity to draw on in later years. It wasn't like it died. And I feel like that story kind of has almost like a Doyle's maybe hope or something that the KKK and what they stand for is going to subside after this. But unfortunately, that, of course, we all know did not happen.
Yeah, I mean, because Conan Doyle himself was quite a big fighter for social justice.
Right.
Like, he did a lot to help people, especially in the United Kingdom, who were facing, like, you know, racial discrimination.
Yes.
So that was something that was
important
to him.
And I think that's another reason I appreciate the story as well, because as much as the story is not about race, you know, there's a few different stories in the Holmes canon that touch on racial equality and racial justice. And I appreciate the fact that, you know, Doyle as a writer and then Holmes and Watson as characters have no, you know, yes, they are men of their time, but they don't have a lot of space for ridiculous prejudices and things like that.
Yeah. One thing that I hadn't really considered before until you mentioned the fact that this was your favorite case is that it's a particularly good one to continue to write about. And I'm really excited about this book because I always found that Five Orange Pips was a very frustrating case to read. Mm-hmm. It was one that was memorable. And I remember being very shocked at the way events turned out because it hadn't occurred to me that he would have failed his client quite so badly.
Right.
And I was left with not a good feeling at the end of it, that things had been mismanaged and that there must be more to the story. Mm-hmm. And it hadn't really sunk in that this was going to be a really fertile ground for someone else to pick up where it left off.
Yeah, I agree with that because I think, you know, it is an interesting one. It's obviously, like Sarah said, not a particularly, like, cheery one, and it does leave you, I feel like most of the Sherlock Holmes cases that you actually have the full case recorded are very, you know, they're very closed. They're very point A to point B, kind of. But with this...
Yeah, they're like the serial dramas, you know, like exactly. We were saying before, like crime dramas.
Right. They lend themselves to the very, you know, modern sort of procedural concept. And this one really does not. It's the one that kind of you're left with a sort of feeling like it's not quite tied up. And, you know, in my second book, I talked about the, you know, what happened to James Phillimore, the case, the man who went out of his house into his house to fetch his umbrella and was never seen again. And, you know, a lot of pastiche writers and people interested in Sherlock Holmes fan fiction writers will continue stories that Watson mentions, like the giant rat of Sumatra, stuff like that. And, you know, I feel like it's easy to sort of have a list of the unfinished tales and kind of go down them and go, oh, I'm going to write about this one now. I'm going to write about this one now. And in this book, I did not want to do that. I wanted to connect to the canon because that's why I write, but I wanted to go somewhere that would echo and remind and kind of link to a canon story, but not kind of like I'm ticking down a list of Watson's unfinished tales, if you know what I mean. Not quite so formulaically go, oh, I talked about James Fillmore, now I'm going to talk about, you know, whatever. It's time for the giant rat, you know. And, well, go ahead.
There is also a sense in I get in some of Conan Doyle's stories, especially because of the way that the author, like John Watson, writes, is that like quite a lot of the time he's not even telling the truth anyway. Like we're getting a kind of sanitized version, whereas this story it seems as if like some of the details aren't as sanitized as they are in like the other cases, and that probably is like what makes it quite an interesting story, and it has that kind of, you know, open-ended feeling. I'm quite excited to read your book, Amy.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, and it was, I wish I could, but I don't even remember the moment that I went, this is the one, you know, this is the story that I want to tell. But it was from reading that story and feeling that way, and it has such a historical feel, like you said before. It really does feel like, you know, if we look at sort of Watson's, you know, truth versus, you know, obfuscation of certain details, this one feels like it really is the story. And it's the straight on story without a lot of embellishment, and it is, you know, about an ugly aspect of history. And I think, you know, it's one where a lot in a similar way to something like Charles Augustus Milverton, it presents a situation where the sort of evil that's presented is a very one of the most interesting aspects of it. The fact that I think it's a really chilling story because you have a sense where these people are hunting people down and they're powerful and they're unknown. And that's definitely a sense that I wanted to keep in my book is in kind of placing that in the London context, a sense where I feel like when you finish that story, you still feel like the power of the KKK in it and the people involved are still kind of an unknown quantity. it's kind of like Holmes has, you know, has shelved that and gone, well, that's gone, you know, that's self-contained back in the United States. They have to deal with it.
Yeah, it's not our problem, really.
Exactly. And I feel like I think if you're thinking of something like a bad version of Pandora's box, you know, what if that thing that was never really contained, which unfortunately even today rears its ugly head now and then,
yeah,
what if it bleeds back over into Holmes's world? What would happen? So that's kind of where I was going with it.
Yeah, speaking of the history, actually, like, how much research did you do into, like, events that happened sort of around the time of the book, of the story? Like, did you do a lot of research into the way that the kind of KKK spread their kind of influence, if that is the right word, like, across, or did you just kind of go from sort of basic knowledge?
Both, because I do hail from the South, and parts of my family have for many, many years, and I also did specific research and found that, interestingly, when the KKK, right before kind of the time of that Doyle set the story, had, you know, it was first formed from Confederate, if people aren't aware of the history of it, it's a racist organization, and it was originally formed of former Confederate soldiers and families who, after they lost the Civil War in the United States, were angry about Reconstruction and things that happened in the South, and formed an organization to try to uphold very negative, very racist principles.
Ooh, yeah, very nasty.
And that was kind of the first wave, is kind of the ending of the first wave is kind of what Doyle is writing about. But what happened was, when they were kind of forced underground, if you will, they still gained a huge amount of power, and they ended up having a lot of political influence. It was just that it went underground. It was almost like that unfortunate thing that happens in a lot of cases where something gets bigger because it's
Because people subjugating them,
exactly.
You know, obviously for good reason, because it was an awful organization.
I mean, there's a cause, unfortunately, that gives people even more of a cause, and it's like, it becomes a thing that, and so I found in my research that while a lot of it went underground, unfortunately, it almost gained more institutionalized power, because people could hold those principles and be part of it without being formal members of something, and, you know, they were still kind of in a, you know, in their own little back, you know, back room kind of meetings, making deals and things like that, and gaining an unfortunate amount of power. And I found, you know, the idea of just of the fallout of that, because right soon after that, in the early 1900s, there was a resurgence of the KKK hugely, and that's when you start to see, you know, the really iconic images of the crosses and the, you know,
the white hoods.
The white hoods.
Things, yeah.
Now, that was an interesting thing I found, because that's very much the image that I've seen, and unfortunately, it's still a contemporary image in parts of some of the South. Looking at it, that original first wave of what Doyle was writing about didn't have those images associated with it. And so I found myself needing to be more creative as I, you know, expressed what I was writing about, because I didn't have all of that to fall back on. It's a very recognizable organization and what it stands for, and definitely still espoused very similar principles at that time, but had less of a sort of iconography of its own, if you will.
Yeah, it didn't develop until later. I mean, that's one of the funny things about adapting that story. Like, I remember Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss said that they just basically avoided it because, like, everybody knows what the KK is now. Like, it's not like a mystery like it was back then. You know, what do these three letters mean?
And that it was more, definitely. And that calls for a level of creativity, because you don't have the you know, you're not going to sort of surprise people. It's kind of like when you're talking about any of the things like drug use, or, you know, any of those things that we see differently at this point in time. It's, you don't have that as a mysterious element. The mystery has to derive from something other than what that actually is.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, like, writing that kind of, well, it's almost historical fiction, really, isn't it? Because you have to think, okay, what would be
definitely mysterious
to a modern audience?
Definitely. It does fall over into the more, I guess, playing the game kind of area where it's intersecting with, you know, not anybody famous to the level of, like, Thomas Edison, like I did in my first one, but it definitely bumps into historical events, I would say.
One thing that always struck me about Five Orange Pips is that when Watson is first learning who they are and what they're about, the subject of racism isn't really brought up. And today we, you know, constantly associate these things with racism, civil war, and slavery. And I'm wondering if you happen to know what Victorian English ideas and opinions were about slavery in the South.
Those aspects would have been understood as part of the Confederate cause. Mm-hmm. I think when he, I mean, obviously not being English, I don't, you know, obviously study the American Civil War from an English perspective, mm-hmm. but there was, you know, there's so much to it that ties with the states' rights issues in the United States. And I think the way that he portrays them is almost like they're not just racist. I don't think he's necessarily completely excluding racism, although he doesn't take it as a major, obviously he doesn't like have that as a big theme. But I think he's saying these are just generally bad people. He's saying, mm-hmm. you know, they not only are they, do they hold very, you know, negative viewpoints, but they also would like to overthrow the American government because that was a huge part of it at that time.
Yeah, and they're willing to kill people to
do it. Exactly, exactly. You know, and even the ones who maybe have backed off from their views are still willing to kill people to keep it quiet. And so I feel like his purpose for that story was to highlight their ruthlessness more than their specific political, like that doesn't seem to have been his focus as much. I mean, as far as sort of attitudes towards slavery, I think pretty much most of the modern civilized world, you know,
I think I can probably answer that question a little bit more, because obviously we learned a little bit about the American Civil War, but we learned a lot about the slave trade in school. Is actually something we study, because we learn about like why slaves were taken to the South and like how
sure.
that kind of all happened. And there was quite a big abolitionist movement in the UK
mm-hmm.
Around that kind of time. But if you read some of the literature, there's still a sense of like almost like misguidedness.
Mm-hmm.
They still kind of say quite racist things.
Yes.
Because there's just like, but they obviously believe that slavery is wrong, but they've not quite come to the full kind of conclusion
right.
that like, you know, that they're just like, that we're all just people, you know. It's kind of, it's interesting to look, but it's very opinionated, but they still were like a lot of abolitionists at the time. And there's quite a lot of interesting things you can see especially if you go to Liverpool in the United Kingdom. There are things hidden around Liverpool because Liverpool was a big port city and some of the slaves used to come through there. And if you look at some of the architecture, there are actually like hidden sort of slaves basically like holding up things like within the architecture of like some of the older
oh, wow.
buildings. So there is a bit of the culture kind of hidden away like here, but it predates like American stuff because obviously we abolished slavery
right.
quite a bit earlier, which is, if you watch the film Amazing Grace, you'll know all about
yes.
that.
Yes, well, I was going to say that Amazing Grace is a great film for anybody who's interested in the abolition of the slave trade in the UK. I would say this for people reading the book does not take racism as a massive theme, but like Doyle, I concentrated on the issues surrounding the organization of the KKK and the fact that these are people who are very willing to, you know, do whatever they have to do to protect themselves. And so it's much more about the mystery aspects of what they are after and willing to do as it is a treatise on anything in particular, although certainly Holmes and Watson and Irene Adler and any related people obviously do not approve or appreciate the viewpoints held by the KKK.
No.
but it's not a huge aspect of the work, because I did want to honor and stick with kind of the theme and direction of where Doyle went with it.
Do you think that's something that could be made into a novel in the future, like if somebody else wanted to focus more on the kind of the Sherlock Holmes fighting the kind of the racial attitude of the time?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think a lot of people effectively have, you know, I always talk about Laurie R. King because I am a huge fan of her work, but she definitely throughout her books casts Holmes as a very modern figure. And I think, you know, on the Baker Street Babes, we talk about that now and then, the fact that he, you know, looks kind of forward in his views. And I think he's, you know, Doyle gave him a voice that's very, I think he has a voice for equality, whether it's racial or, you know,
class
gender,
system, kind of equality,
class
yeah.
system, any particular, I mean, not without a hiccup here and there, like you were saying, you still see, you know, unfortunate terminologies and things
yes.
that are not
yeah.
completely correct.
Yeah, certain descriptions of people
right.
in the novels, yeah.
but you generally have, you know, the pervading idea that there's no, you know, even stories that are very problematic, like The Yellow Face, you see a perspective that doesn't draw distinctions between race, or, you know, you see with something like his treatment of Mary Morstan, that he doesn't even draw a distinction of gender other than Holmes having particular personal hang-ups.
Yes, about women and...
Exactly, and that's a whole... I see that personally as kind of a separate issue, because it's obviously a very personal situation for Holmes, but... I think you know, anybody could take, and people have, you know, if there's a social issue that somebody feels dovetails with Holmes, I think that could work. I mean, I could totally see it working.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of room for people to write, like, well, like, write more. So, Amy, get writing, you know. Write us another novel.
Well, and I did, I will say, in my second book, for anybody who hasn't read it, I do deal slightly with, there's a reference to the women's suffrage movement in it, that Holmes is a supporter of women's suffrage, which
yeah,
he would be.
He would be. He'd probably have blue stockings on underneath his trousers.
You heard it here first.
As a sign of support, yeah.
Heard it here first.
How difficult is it then to, do you find when you write that you take a lot from Conan Doyle's style, or do you find that your own voice kind of comes through more when you're writing the novel?
You know, it's interesting because when I wrote the first book, I kind of intentionally took it out of context, because I'm like, I know I'm doing something by having Sherlock Holmes and Irene Adler meet back up, and I'm not, you know, and not doing it in at all a sexualized way. I knew I was doing something very different and very off canon and whatever. And as I've, you know, come down the line, this third book is in London. It's very much more of a canonical setting. And, you know, when I write it, and then I don't, not that I don't think about it, but I'm not consciously imitating anybody or anything like that. But my first reader said, you know, this is much more like the canon than the other two. And I think that that had to do with partially the fact that it was so tied to the Five Orange Pips, and then the fact that it had the London setting and I have the London, you know, the London characters, if you will. Having it somewhere else didn't give me, you know, a lot of Mrs. Hudson or a lot of... you know, you don't really see Mycroft or anything like that when you're not in the London. And even Watson really wasn't in the first one. He did have a big part in the second one, but you know, being back in Baker Street, you know, me doing all the research back to remind myself of canonical stuff, I think really put my head kind of in that direction. And I also think plot-wise, because it's a very, you know, fast-paced, London-based, Lestrade, you know, and the yard are involved, it does have definitely more of a canon anchor to it than the first two.
What was your personal favorite part or scene for you to write?
You know, I love
no spoilers.
Oh, no spoilers. I have a lot of things I love.
Oh, right, if possible.
Yes.
Well, not too many spoilers, but
which of your children did you love most?
Exactly. You know, I love a lot of aspects. One of my favorite parts is the fact that I did involve Mycroft in this one more, and he's always been a presence because I feel like when I read the canon, Mycroft is mentioned, I think, in 4 stories, if I'm not mistaken, and he's always such a large presence in more ways than one. And I think in this one, I wanted to involve him, and he's not in it constantly. It's not one of these things where Mycroft is suddenly running around London, because I just really can't, you know, I can't see that, but I love inventing. I think one of my favorite things across the board is inventing details, because there's so many details that Doyle does not give about their lives and the day-to-day little things that happen. And so one of my favorite things is at one point in the book, Sherlock goes to Mycroft's flat and he kind of gets Mycroft out of bed because Mycroft is in his private rooms in a dressing gown smoking and reading Russian novels. Because when I was thinking about how I wanted to frame that particular encounter, I just had this image of Mycroft Holmes in my head as this person who, you know, is very mysterious and is very, you know, has such a big brain, and I just had this vision of him kind of in this, you know, oversized giant dressing gown, you know, sitting in his sort of chaise lounge reading something like Tolstoy at like 1 a.m. just amused me.
And just he'd probably read the whole thing in one night.
Exactly.
And then read it again.
Exactly.
Speaking in Russian.
And I also was able to include some backstory for characters like Mrs. Hudson that are very present in the canon, but that we don't get a lot of details on. And because Irene Adler is female, I have a little more of a window into her being able to connect with Mrs. Hudson in a different way than we normally see. So that was a lot of fun as well.
Did you find that Irene Adler was kind of a natural inclusion in the novel, or was that very heavily kind of planned that she would be in it?
Well, the series is the Detective and the Woman series, and so I always include, like, Irene to me is an integral part of, you know, I would never shut the door on saying I might write a more traditional pastiche at some point. But for this particular series of books, Irene is as important to me as Sherlock Holmes is, which I know is heresy to some people. But for me personally, the way that I see the character and that I frame the character, she's always present in my mind when I'm writing them. And in this case, the case comes to Holmes's attention because Irene in Sussex suddenly deals with the unexpected death of her beehives, and that's where the Silent Hive name comes from. And that's not too much of a spoiler, because you're going to find that out on like page 1, but it's, you know, there's an unexplained you know, and for her a very difficult loss there, and so it's her sort of coming to London with this perplexing issue of her bees suddenly dying of a mysterious disease that kind of jumpstarts that. And her being present naturally kind of flows into the case. And I think it works naturally because I don't write them as... they're not romantically entangled. They're not... you know, they're not in competition with each other. It's very much a situation where at this point with a third book where they've known each other now for an extended period of time, it's two people who respect each other's abilities and each other's judgment, and are able to rely on each other's ability to further the investigation.
So it's not quite a buddy cop thing, but it's
No,
almost.
not quite. I mean, there's Watson is definitely present in this one, and it's very helpful, obviously.
What time is it sort of set in the canon then? Like, is it after
It's
John has moved out?
post-Great Hiatus. Watson is living at Baker Street. I don't want to spoil too much because that does come into the book. The point of
Okay.
And if you've, for people who have read book two, they will know that John's situation, I'll just say, John's situation has the potential of changing in the near future.
Ooh.
So, yeah, that's a little spoiler, little reason to read book two and three. But he is in a slightly transitional period of his life, but he is living in 221B at the time. And Irene is obviously not living in 221B. I did not feel that that would have been even for
It's a little bit inappropriate in a Victorian
exactly, which
setting.
she does actually say, because I do write all three books are first person from Irene's perspective half the time and third person about Holmes's movements, because otherwise they would have to be doing, I like to write in particular perspectives. And obviously, they're not together all the time, so it helps me to have kind of an alternating voice. But even for her, I have her say at one point, even for her with her sort of bohemian ideals, does not feel that staying in Baker Street would be terribly appropriate. So she's actually lodging at the Savoy Hotel, and that is one of the historical things that I found really interesting. I did a lot of research because the Savoy Hotel, which is right obviously ne near the historic theater, had just been completed, and it was one of the first of its kind, which had like electric lights. It had speaking tubes where you could talk to like the floor waiter, get room service. I mean, en suite bathrooms, things that had never been seen before. And so I was able, that was one of the things that I also really enjoyed writing was, looking at historical photos of the Savoy, reading about the operations of the hotel, what a sort of historical moment it was when it was completed, because it was such a totally modern institution. And so she's lodging there during the story, and actually part of the case itself takes place there. And that was really interesting for me.
Is
I quite
Godfrey
like
completely out of the
so.
picture?
If you okay, it's funny because I know people come into the series at different points. Godfrey is dead on the first page of the first book.
Ah,
So
poor Godfrey.
he is completely out of the picture. In sort of in my conception, for people who might want to jump into book three, that's another point. You don't have to have read books one and two.
Okay.
You can jump into book three with the knowledge that Irene is living in the farm in Sussex. That's kind of the main thing to know. And Godfrey was not a good guy in my conception of him. So I won't go into huge detail because that's the first book. But if he did not turn out to be a positive aspect of Irene Adler's life. So part of even through book three, Irene is someone who has come back from a very difficult marriage and a certain amount of personal tragedy. And in book three, we see her as someone whose life has largely normalized, but is again having to deal with something that kind of throws a huge wrench into the works.
I'll ask you the same thing I asked Lauren R. King. Are you going to keep writing these as long as you're allowed, or do you have a plan for how long this might go on?
Well, and that's a good question. It's one I've asked myself. I mean, obviously there's three, which is a nice trilogy, and my publisher likes the trilogy concept. I do have other ideas. There are certain aspects of characters that as I write, I think, ooh, what if I, what if I went in this direction with this character? Or, what about this story that I've bumped into, but I'm not really telling? And it kind of gives me a lot of empathy with Doyle and the fact that he had all these stories that he obviously kind of litters through the canon stories as if, you know, if I ever have a minute and I want to tell this one, I'll tell it. And I kind of start to feel that way. And the books are not hugely long. And so I don't feel like, you know, I don't exhaust my entire idea storage on each book. So I always have more. And I particularly have an idea for a book 4 because of things that are happening in Watson's life, which people who have read the previous books would know and definitely will know if they read this one. And so definitely the next book could concentrate a little bit more on that, so we'll see.
Now, is there any advice you would give somebody who is thinking about writing their own pastiche?
You know, I would say, goodness, that, you know, I've been asked that a lot, and it's a great question, and I would say, first of all, I would say go for it, because, you know, even Doyle at the time, famously, of course, is quoted as saying, you know, marry him or murder him or do whatever you like to William Gillette, and, I think there's a lot of people love Sherlock Holmes, and it's a wonderful community of people. And a lot of people who, you know, a huge subset of people who like Holmes like to read other stories about Holmes. Because Doyle, I believe, the sparsity of detail that he gives is such a gift to other writers, because there's so much left to tell. And I'd never think that too much is, you know, there's never too much if it's done well and if people are passionate about it. You know, the only time that I have any problem with it is if somebody is trying to involve Holmes because they know it's popular right now or something like that. But if somebody truly loves Holmes and they love the stories, or even, you know, they love Sherlock, obviously you can jump in with fan fiction if it's a particular adaptation that people are into. I started as a fan fiction writer, and honestly, if I have any advice on how to get started, that might be my biggest advice, is that there are places online, you know, there's Archive of Our Own, fanfiction.net, other more specialized sites where you're able to share, and it's low risk, it's not doesn't cost anything, and you can get your writing out there. And for me, starting with fan fiction gave me a lot of confidence, and then when I wrote a book that, you know, having positive feedback from people and good criticism really helped me out. So I would say to people, get writing, and that will kind of help you to gain the confidence you might need to go from writing maybe a short story all the way to like a full novel.
Brilliant. Well put.
Thank you.
Where can we buy your book from, Amy? Those of us are with eager, sticky fingers.
Yes. My publisher is mxpublishing.com. It's just the letter M, the letter X, publishing.com. And all three of my books are available there. They are available on Amazon. The series so far is The Detective and the Woman, The Detective, the Woman, and the Winking Tree, and The Detective, the Woman, and the Silent Hive is the new one. They're available through BarnesandNoble.com. For people who might want to jump into this series, it's a bookshop. It's at the Sherlock Holmes Hotel, and it's called the Watson's Lounge Bookshop. And it's a bundle of all three books, and it's basically a three for two special with free shipping.
Very nice.
And so for people who might not have read them yet and want to catch up, and they will get the third book as soon as it's off press, so they won't have to wait the extra like time till it comes out.
Oh, that's excellent.
And for people who do ebooks, because I do a lot, I read a lot of ebooks, that kind of thing. My books are available on Kobo.com, although I don't believe the third one is yet. The main way I always just say is go through Amazon, because Amazon is the easy, you know, it's the easy way to get ebooks.
Oh yes, I like a good ebook. Yes, so that'll be where I get my phone.
Well, and that's the thing for me, because I'm a Nook user, Kindle user. You know, I love having the choice is there, and it's a little cheaper than, so if you're a physical book lover, you can get them off the publisher or Amazon, and if you're more of an ebook lover, ebook off Amazon is probably the easiest way.
Brilliant.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, if people want to learn more, I do have a blog. It's a WordPress blog. It's Girl Meets, just like the regular words, girlmeetssherlock.wordpress.com. If people want to check me out there, there'll be like more information about the book and where to get it and things like that.
That's your Tumblr username as well, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
So you can also follow Amy on Tumblr.
I'm on Tumblr as both of those. Tumblr and WordPress are Girl Meets Sherlock. And then Twitter, I'm Pickwick12. So PICKWICK12. And I have all book news and stuff like that on there too.
Fabulous. Well, thank you very much, Amy. It was exciting to hear about your new novel.
I appreciate you guys. I think I did want to say to anybody who is thinking about going to 221 BCon this year, several of us will be attending. The Baker Street Babes, we will be doing a live podcast like we did last year. So if you are going to be in the Atlanta area the first weekend of April, we would love to see you at 221 BCon. So I hope that you guys will all register and come over and see us.
Hooray!
Yay, it's a bunch of fun.
It is.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?